the way the economy is going, we have buildings that are moving toward obsolescence. We're not using certain office buildings anymore. We look at office buildings all the time as a potential change of use and repositioning it. Can it be affordable housing or workforce housing? In theory, it's an office park. Is it near jobs? Yes. Do we have potential? Yes. Does it have built-in parking? Yes. We look at strategies like that.
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com. Today on the show, I had the pleasure of speaking with Kurt Volkmann. Kurt has over 30 years' experience as a thought leader in urban planning, redefining the future of real estate with his pioneering evidence-based designs rooted in sustainability and wellness. He is currently pushing the boundaries as an associate principal in the multifamily housing and mixed-use space at HED, one of America's largest architecture and engineering firms valued over $100 million. Now, given he has vast building expertise across many different market sectors, Kurt brings an enlightened urbanism approach to mixed-use design that guarantees a rewarding long-term impact for all stakeholders involved, from promoting social equity and equality for users to supporting profitable returns for real estate developers and investors. I'm really pumped and excited to have him on the show today to share his incredible experience with us. But enough out of me. Let's get him out of here. G'day, Kurt. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today, mate?
Great. Thank you for inviting me on, Reid. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. We were saying in the green room that you are an architect, and I'm a former structural engineer, and I've spent many years from London to the US to Australia working with architects, being a structural engineer. So we come cut from the same cloth, so to speak. But let's get into your background. The first question I like to ask everyone on this show is, rewind the clock and tell me how you made your first of a dollar as a kid.
How I made my first dollar as a kid was cutting lawns and doing yard work for neighbors that little older than I, even when my parents. So my parents were like, hey, go help them out. So I was able to cut a lawn and do some yard work and kind of help them keep their home upkept.
Nice. And give us a walk through memory lane of how you've got to where you are today. You're an architect. Was you always the plan to become an architect and get into urban planning?
It was. I'd say probably the first time I thought about being an architect was the age of three. I was super young. My uncle was in the AAA Motor Club for Chicago, taking people on these incredible tours across Europe and Asia. And then would come back and kind of regale us with stories of capsules and palaces and these beautiful churches and so forth, and bringing books and travel guides with them, and just being able to sit down and, show you these images. And it just was, a fantastic entry into architecture and what it could be, whether it be historic or, at the time, what was cutting edge in the 70s in London, for instance, or in Paris, or even in Bangkok. So it was always just something that just seemed like, oh, my God, you could do this anywhere in the world. And it was just, he had the ability to just be creative and thoughtful. It was just always something that was enjoyable. And I've carried that through my whole life. I had really faltered in my belief that I should be an architect and planner.
Nice. And you work for HED, right? Are they based in Chicago?
HED is a national practice. We originated in Detroit and grew across the United States. So we're well over 460 employees nationally. That is architects, interior designers, landscape architects, MEP, and structural engineers. We have a very integrated practice. Is that sounds that that's true to what we are. We practice what we preach. We're really key on designing high performance buildings. So we look to optimize performance of the buildings as much as possible to, minimize operating expense for owners. And just, overall comfort for the end user.
Talk to me a little bit about, for the listeners who may not be super aware of urban based planning, right? And just breaking that down for how we as a society, we talk a lot about on the investment side, you know, this movement towards a rent-a-nation as affordability becomes really unsustainable. But then talk about from your side of the coin, from a design perspective with local cities and municipalities, thinking more about the bigger picture of urban planning.
Urban planning's been around for centuries at this point. And, you know, some of the earliest planners in the Greek and Roman era, it was meant to kind of create sense of understanding of your city, right? And they understood it, you know, the Romans, anytime they went to a new place, they set up the cities the exact same way we saw with the Spaniards when they colonized. And really what it amounts to is it's a true understanding of what a city truly needs at its heart and then how it should grow from there. So when we look at today's world, right, we, you know, as an architect, and engineers and planners, we deal with zoning codes across the country that tell us, hey, you can only build what this is here, or you have to go through a process of changing the zoning code, which is probably many of your listeners know is a very expensive and laborious process. But we help, you know, through that process, because one thing we find with zoning codes is they're very hard to stay current. And it's a challenge for a lot of these municipalities, especially when they grow so big, is to stay current up on market conditions and market dynamics. So we have to come in a lot of times with our clients and say, yes, this isn't as of right. We need to kind of look at a change. Here's what that change process is to get this to go. The cities always want to look at it in a very holistic sense. It's great you want to change this one parcel, let's say, but we have to look at it in its totality across the city and what that actually means. And a lot of that could come from physical use and hours of operation. It could mean property tax and sales tax, and just ultimately what that does. So for us as architects and planners, we try to kind of think about it in those two scales, right? What is the importance to our developer partners and what they're trying to do? And we want to obviously listen to them. But at the same time, we have to be sensitive to what the city's looking for. Otherwise, we're never going to get approvals and go from there. So sometimes we have to help our developer partners make the business case of why this is important at a city level to make this justification for a zoning change.
And second part of that question is, how have you seen urban planning develop and change over the years, given how we as a society are interacting and post-COVID and, you know, the house in the suburbs may not be the American dream anymore, like all that sort of stuff?
Well, the American dream is that's a podcast series in its own. We can go through that at a much different time. But I think even before COVID, we saw back in the previous recession from there, back in, you know, 2008 through 2012, and then the rise of Amazon, that really changed the dynamic quickly. And a lot of cities have struggled even to this day, have not caught up to what that dynamic is in terms of what online retailing is, what's a fulfillment center, how can that reestablish. So what we're seeing, like at least in the U.S., is before the pandemic, it was a reduction of about 30% of the need of retail square footage. And since the pandemic, we've proven that we didn't need any retail at the time, right, during the heat of the pandemic. And since then, retail has come back because people do realize there is a level of touch that needs to occur when buying goods. So I think what we're trying to get a real understanding is, at least in kind of the mixed-use world, is what is actually needed, what is the right amount of square footage. Cities are slow to react to that because they don't understand. They're not in the real estate world per se. They're in kind of the public safety and kind of public health world. So we have to sometimes work with cities and say, hey, this is what we need. That's why we don't necessarily need all this parking and we don't need all this real estate because we don't need that much square footage anymore. So it's getting them to understand, you know, some of the dynamics that exist out there. And, you know, it often makes us look like the bad guy to the city sometimes because we're telling them what to do. But zoning codes are hard to change. I'm on a municipal board myself in the town I live in, and they've gone through about an 18-month process just to change their zoning code. And I guarantee it's parts of it are probably out of date, and it's only been up for 2 months.
It's very interesting in how it all comes together and making sure that you are balancing the the safety aspect of the local officials versus what you're trying to do from an architectural point of view to keep up with the times. And ultimately, as you just mentioned there, you're going to have a cesspool of red tape and taking a long time to get approvals. So,
but there's also concepts like walks, you know, walk score and so forth, and bike score, where, you know, this nebulous formula that sits out there. We know it's important. So then it's all of a sudden, you know, do you have to think about it in a very rudimentary sense? And it's like, oh, I need to put these, you know, certain functions in because that'll give me a good walk score. Walk score then translates to sales price. So we look for what that all means. And then we kind of work with our developer partners and say, hey, is this something important to you? And sometimes they say yes, sometimes they say no. And that helps us kind of figure out what the program of the building is eventually, and then, or full development as it is. And then we can go back to the city and say, here's how we're going to try to help.
Let's dig into the nuts and potatoes of what you do, and which is in and around mixed use and trying to advise developers and investors on the benefits of mixed use. Because, and for those people out there, mixed use meaning more than likely retail on the first floor, multi-family housing on the top, on the upper floors. You know, those tenants can feed the businesses in the retail space. It's usually in more built-up areas. You wouldn't see that out in the suburbs, not so much. But walk us through about how you're really trying to redefine the mixed-use space, so people are more not thinking, well, I've got to build Class A high-end amenities with it, with versus the you know, the affordable housing, because it just doesn't pencil because you can't get as much rent.
So one of the things we start to look at here at HED is a concept of, we titled it MAUI. So that's a mix of age, use, and incomes. And what we look for there is to, you know, if you have an opportunity within, you know, a master development to look for strategies for creating traffic on an 18-hour-a-day basis, right? So that's foot traffic and vehicular traffic. These are still tried and true measures of, you know, potential success for all the different uses that exist today. So in that, we, you know, when we look at these master developments, or even sometimes within a single building, you know, we have the opportunity to do that. Now, there's a lot of laws, obviously, in the U.S. where we're, you know, required to put so much affordable housing in and workforce housing and so forth, right? And in that, workforce housing and affordable housing really want to be close to the jobs, where the job creation is. And the reason being is these are people that are kind of anywhere from, you know, no median, you know, rent not affordable in the median income area, right? Versus 60 to 120% of the median income area that they live in. And so to then add an extreme expense like transit or transportation into that, it kind of, yeah, I can build you an affordable house, but if you're way out of, you know, way out in the sticks, it doesn't do you any good. So getting people closer to the jobs, whether it be service jobs, professional jobs, whatever, is kind of important. We're seeing this obviously in urban areas, and it's a lot easier to do that and get and bring people closer to jobs. But we're starting to see it more and more in the suburban areas as well, is this kind of stratification of mixed age, use, and income, and getting people there. A lot of municipalities I've talked to, you know, before the pandemic, they would nix, like, oh, I don't want seniors living here. They don't spend money. They don't do anything. And like, now we're working, you know, we're active adult communities, or we're working where we have people in their 60s and even into their 70s in great health. And they're working into that, those areas. They have disposable income. They need a place, an empty nester home to stay, for instance. So, you know, they don't want to do the upkeep of a house. So whether it's rental or condo, they're looking to downsize, and there aren't those opportunities being built. I was at a conference over a year ago in Austin, Texas, and Henry Cisneros was talking about this, how we need to build empty nester housing that doesn't exist today to get people out of these houses. And then you get that sort of arbitrage of housing sales that allows younger families into communities. And then, you know, those younger families then populate the schools, you know, grocery stores see different activity and so forth. So it's this natural cycle that needs to occur in a lot of municipalities and urban and suburban areas that help it, you know, kind of maintain and thrive. And is then you've also given a place to stay for, you know, seniors in this empty nester housing, for instance. And if you can do it in a mix of incomes, then you have people who can work locally, support the local economies, and then you create, you know, destination retail and amplification retail, such as like a doctor's office. I think, I forget the study, but there was one study that like that after someone goes to the doctor, the chance of them picking up a coffee or something like that is like, you know, over 50%. So it's like that's something that brings automatic foot traffic in the middle of the day, but then all of a sudden can benefit a separate retail entity just by virtue of creating that foot traffic and ease of access.
You mentioned a lot of things there, but you know, the number one thing that we hear on the investing side is that the cost of construction just doesn't pencil for, you know, medium to affordable housing when you're building these mixed use. So how are you tackling that in today's landscape?
A couple of different ways. Right now, I mean, the way the economy is going, we have buildings that are kind of moving toward obsolescence in a way, right? So we're not using certain office buildings anymore. So we, you know, we look at office buildings all the time as a potential change of use and repositioning it. Can it be affordable housing or workforce housing? In theory, it's an office park. Is it near jobs? Yes. Is it, do we have potential? Yes. Does it have built-in parking? Yes. So we look at strategies like that. Does it make sense? I will be honest, only about 25% of office buildings you look at are really convertible, right? And in for a number of different factors. I've had one where the cost of changing the plumbing was too much. The other was the sale price. That was a couple of years ago. Now the sales price of these office buildings have come down to a point where it's we're going to start to see a little bit more of those in, right? You know, remote work has kind of created this obsolescence of some of these buildings. We're seeing it in just any general renovations or repositioning of existing apartment buildings too. Sometimes it's nice to, you know, you get an apartment building from the 60s and 70s. What's great about those is they're pretty big units. So then if you can refresh those and update kitchens and baths and take that on, they might become great empty nester housing units because they're a little bit bigger. And that's kind of what the people moving out of a house need. So, I mean, I think there's opportunities everywhere to kind of reposition buildings and cut some of that initial cost. When it comes to new construction, we obviously look at ways where we can be efficient in how we create a building to minimize cost, whether it's, you know, trying to minimize the amount of trades we mobilize on a project so that we're not getting extra overhead and profit built in on the general contractor side. Being very efficient in, like I said, with the building performance. You might not see that cost savings up front, but you'll see it over the life of the building when the operating expense is lower. So we have different strategies to try to tackle all of that.
Yep. No, it's definitely a space that it's interesting, and you got to really crunch the numbers. I guess as you look forward into your crystal ball, what are you seeing the next wave of? You know, maybe it is the empty nesters, maybe, but is there something else you're seeing out there that's going to change the way urban planning is done? You know, we think of all the black swan events, you know, the COVIDs of the world, and now we're seeing the empty nesters of the world. What else are you seeing out there that's going to, you know, affect the way we design our cities?
Well, I think the biggest need, and it's a need nationally in the United States, is the need for workforce housing. So there's an approximate need of about 7.5 million new residential units. In that, the workforce housing component of that is about 4.3. So it takes up well more than half. These are people, basically, you're talking rents from 60 to 120 per AMI, right? The average median income of the areas that are in. So that is an opportunity because they need that. And an empty nester a lot of times falls into that as well. So I think it's important to say, here's where the opportunities are, right? And what are strategies and ways that, you know, you can approach that as a developer or an architect or so forth. I think the other aspect of it is we have, you know, all again, going back to the concept of what's becoming obsolete, you know, society changes so fast. So right now there's a lot of mall renovations and we're engaged in a few where, you know, you don't need a whole lot of big box retail anymore. They don't need to have, you know, 120 to 2,000, you know, 200,000 square feet. So, you know, any big box retailer, that big box alone can be 14 to 16 acres. Well, you can build four buildings on that potentially, right? Properly. So what do you want to do to help these municipalities? Because when that big box retail fails, that municipality isn't getting sales tax or property tax to the same rate it was before. So towns are hurting for that to replace that. So there are strategies to come back in and find, renovation opportunities. So I think what I like to do with our developer partners is just purely trying to find a way to, kind of help them strategize how to find new opportunities out there in the world, especially with products that are potentially going obsolete.
Majority of buildings that we live in, and as a former structural engineer, are existing, right? And breathing new life. That's what we do with our 1960s, 1970s. You're trying to prolong that 50-year horizon that a building was built for back in the day to make it last another 50 years, thinking of HVACs and windows and the envelopes and the roofs and the foundations to keep it affordable. Are you looking at anything in modular housing at all? I know that's been a big one that I know I have a personal interest in. I actually put a local modular housing group under contract. I had to bow out of the deal, but I'm very, very bullish in that space. It's not the solution. It's one of the solutions, in my opinion, but I'd love to hear your two cents on that.
Absolutely. We're finishing up one project out in California, a great project that has a series of townhomes and then kind of low rise garden style buildings kind of coming up from there. We're looking at all different sorts of offsite construction opportunities, again, just to try to speed up the time on site. A lot of that work gets done. It's in terms of like waste and sustainability, it's great product for that because the waste is captured in the factory more times than not, and that factory then can recycle that product right back in, whether it's wood, metal stud, you name it. Yep. We're looking at some offsite construction opportunities with a new hotel project. In hotels specifically, because the speed to market aspect of it, it's very important. So having modularity, because it's a highly repetitive type product, works well. In Florida, we're looking at a couple senior living properties. And again, it's going to have a series of offsite construction elements to it. I don't know if we'll go full modular, but definitely offsite construction. So again, we can think about it in a way that's very repeatable and still comfortable and kind of work itself in. So it doesn't look like you're just, slapping some Legos together. You're actually putting together a building in a very thoughtful way.
Well, I think it all comes down to cost, right? The 4.5 million homes we have to build across the nation may need to be a little bit more repetitive to bring that cost down. But then the other side of the coin, which we all know about and we've spoken about, is the slowness of the local cities to adopt a approval process based on a manufactured housing, i.e., how do you have inspections when you're in a warehouse? How does the lending scenario, I'm going to lend you out more money in advance of product that's not on my site? Like, there's a whole element of the industry has to catch up for it to be a commodity that can be rolled out across the country. I know I live here in Los Angeles. I walked a modular hotel in Hawthorne back in 2014, right? They actually built it in Nevada, shipped them across the state lines. They had local municipalities on board for approvals. It's here, it's ready. It just, does it work well in certain scenarios, and does it have approvals from local authorities or local enthusiasm to have that type of stuff? Again, it's one element, because it's not, you just mentioned the repurpose of existing office. I think that's also super important. Box retail, super important. But it's all these ideas that come together to try and make housing cheaper, to bring up the deficit of 7.4 million just mentioned before. So I think it all's got to go into that sort of the soup to get a better outcome at the end of the day.
Well, absolutely. And I think one of the challenges with modular is the fact that it's off, you're doing all this offsite. So, when we think of modular, yes, you can bring out actual modules themselves. And there's also panelization, mm-hmm. Which I've done as well. And then there's all sort of light gauge framing systems, which then can go up, right? And they all promise, and in my experience, deliver on the fact that general contractors are spending less time on site. Doesn't mean they're necessarily doing less work. They're really not, because there's still a lot of coordination that has to go on. But they're there, and they're looking at all this product and how it goes up. So you can say potentially on a project that I had done, as 278 units. It was just using a offsite light gauge framing system where we were doing all the engineering, they're doing all the fab offsite. It showed up to site. It saved 4 months of construction time. And absolutely fantastic way to go about it and help us achieve a very high sustainable level on that as well.
No, I love it. Whole episode I could have on modular housing, just in terms of how bullish I am. But look, Kurt, at the end of the show, we like to dive into the top five investing tips. Ready to get into it?
Sure, let's do it.
Hey, question number one, what's the daily habit you practice to keep on track towards your goals?
I like to do research. In that, I try to spend 5 minutes a day doing research on design topics that come into mind. I work across multiple sectors. So for me, it's like, you know, thinking about how a woman, you know, potentially in a market rate housing, what are the safety factors for a woman in, you know, various, you know, urban settings or in hotels? What am I looking for in the average, you know, average daily rate that's out there today, and where do I see that projection go? So it could be financial, it could be just how, you know, what breeds safety, a feeling of comfort in an individual. So just anything that gets me churning, you know, the wheels upstairs in about, you know, what it is to design and better help to my development partners.
Question number two is, who's the most influential person in your career to date?
It was a former boss of mine, who unfortunately since passed, Mark DeWalt, but he was just so thoughtful in that he thought about, you know, kind of taught me to think about challenges in a standard project and turn as many unknowns to knowns early on in the process, because that's the way I could be a better resource and tool for my developer partners. And just figuring out ways that I can help them get to a realistic solution faster.
Awesome. Question number three is, what's the most influential tool in your business? When I say influential tool, it could be a physical tool like a journal, or it could be a piece of software you just can't run the business without. What is it?
You know, just in working through ideas, I'm a sucker for having, you know, drawing capability. So Revit is first and foremost, to just get ideas out on the computer. Let me look at it, poke holes at it, show people, have them poke holes at it, and work through a solution in a very iterative process.
You still a fan of butter paper? I know back in the day, you get a butter paper over the plans and get.
Yeah, no, I still do that from time to time, and you know, I'm still the old guy. Every once in a while, we pull it out. We try to be paperless as much as possible, but. You know, in the modern era, kids coming out of school, you know, you pull out trace paper and, you know, it's like fun for them too. So we get to kind of practice and do things, right? You know, architects are, I had a lawyer tell me this once that architects are nothing but lawyers with crayons. So
I like that. I like that a lot. Second to last question is, in one sentence, what's been the biggest failure in your career? What did you learn from that failure?
I didn't get a major project in the city of Chicago. It was a big I had done the master plan for the site. I didn't get the project at the end of the day. It was incredibly frustrating. A lot of the factors of it were out of my control. And so at the end of the day, you know, you just kind of learn to roll with the punches. And I think my emotions didn't necessarily get the better of me, but my emotions were like raw and hurt because I put so much effort into it and the business was still a business. And you know, at the point of not getting the project, it's like, okay, I can't deal with that anymore. And instead of like trying to figure out a way to still get myself involved in the project. So for me, it's like a no, you never know if a no is a hard no or a soft no. You just got to figure out and keep working at it and keep digging, because you never know when that no turns to a yes.
Love it. Last question, mate, where can people reach you to continue the conversation? They'll be in your sphere. Where do they go?
Easiest way to get a hold of me, ATD.co is our website here. I'm in the Chicago office. I work primarily in a couple different sectors in our science and advanced manufacturing, but also our housing and mixed use sector. So I'm on the website. You'll see a lot of my thought leadership on that website as well. And if there's topics that you're interested in, we'll see. I've got a lot of new thought leadership coming up. Where we try to tackle some current topics of the day, whether it be in senior living, workforce housing, and even in some of my science clients.
That's awesome. Well, look, mate, I want to thank you so much for jumping on today's show. I want to reflect some of the things I took away from today. I think the biggest thing I took away from today is that we only had half an hour to discuss, to chat everything urban planning. It's so complex, and there's so many different tools that each municipality will have at its resources or not have at its resources, i.e. repurposing an old building, or i.e. approving that modular housing, or i.e. being more focused on walk scores and bike scores and public transportation versus another another community. And so it all adds to complexity, but I think it's all trying to keep up with the modern times of how we're all living. As you mentioned, I really like the idea of this older generation moving into apartments and having them in a setting that they could also maybe contribute back to society is really, really important, because you don't think about that as a developer. You think about, well, how am I going to get the highest rent per square foot, and you know, how am I going to build it? So I think all of that stuff comes in, and you know, the sausage making, and there's not one shoe, one size fits all. I think it's so much more complex than that, and we have to give people like yourself massive kudos for all the things you're doing in your local communities to not only one, come up with better ideas, but two, bring a community together. Because you know, I think we've learned all post COVID that we do like each other a little bit. We do want to, you know, as much as we like working from home, we're going to want to interact a little bit every now and then. So having someone like you at the helm is going to be really, really important. Did I leave anything out?
No, I think the only other thing about urban planning that I think is important is, like, you could go back in time and look at ancient Samarkand, which was on the Silk Road, predating Marco Polo and all that. And the way that town is set up is the way that our modern towns are set up today. Now, granted, our modern towns have a lot, bigger footprint and a lot of different uses than they did back then. But the same general concepts exist. So we're just constantly trying to build a better mousetrap and just kind of make them, relevant for today.
Love it, mate. Look, I want to thank you so much for jumping on today's show. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll catch up very, very soon.
Well, thank you again, Reid, for inviting me in.
Well, there you have another cracking episode jam-packed with some incredible advice from Kurt. If you want to check out his website, go to hed.co. He's in the Chicago office. He's got a wealth of knowledge around urban planning, architecture, and how we can really modernize our society and bring a cheaper way of building affordable product to the market today. Again, we've got over 7.4 million houses today need to be built to accommodate the growth of America. So again, thank you all for tuning in for today's show to continue to grow your financial IQ. If you do like this show, the easiest way to give back is to share it with a friend or give it a 5-star review on iTunes. And we're going to do this all again next week. So remember, be bold, be brave, and go give life a crack.